North Face faces heat over sponsorship of overnight LGBT camp where kids perform in drag and they explore their sexuality. Isn't that nice? We got a new Illinois law that is coming, it's currently being proposed, that will allow children to get transgender care or have an abortion without the consent of their parent. And we're going to talk a little bit about Donald Trump and what he had to say about abortion and a couple other things. We got a big week ahead of us, so let's jump right in with the North Face. North Face is facing heat over a sponsorship of overnight LGBT camp where kids, you know, explore their sexuality, which is questionable at best. They had a promo video that we're going to show here, and you'll be able to watch. And if you can't watch it, if you're just listening, you can just kind of tell that it's pretty gay.
Hi, it's me, Patagonia, a real-life homosexual. And today, I'm here with the North Face.
We are here to invite you to come out in nature with us.
Wow, this is nice. We like to call this little tour the Summer of Pride. This tour has everything: hiking, community, art, lesbians making art. Last year, we gay sashayed across the nation and celebrated Pride across the nation with hundreds of you across the nation.
This year, we're back again with two new stops:
Atlanta, GA. Why? Because you're there. And Salt Lake City, we're coming for you.
Patty, can we go?
Of course. This year, all these fabulous speakers will be coming from inside this TV to a nature near you. So come outside and celebrate the beautiful LGHGTV community.
Well, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it's the video is a bit of a caricature of itself to start with. I think what you see again is corporate America is not, by definition, conservative. They're doing what they believe is going to yield them the best value for their shareholders.
Definitely. What they think is going to be the most valuable, at the very least.
And I think that it gets tiresome. I mean, but they see, they want to associate their name with a cause like that. And then you're going to have people looking at it and saying, well, wait a second, you're encouraging 12 to 17-year-olds number one, that no gender-segregated housing and so forth. I just have a hard time taking it in and trying to process what they're all trying, what this camp really aims to do. It doesn't seem like it's really teaching any skills. I think it's celebrating identity, and I suppose there are camps for Christians, and there are some very good Jewish camps, overnight camps.
JC something. Well, I applied to
JCC,
work there. Yeah, I applied to work there a few years ago.
And there are a lot of overnight camps that are, you know, Jewish oriented, and there are camps for people of different religious and ethnic backgrounds, but to me, this just seems like
propaganda.
Yeah, propaganda. Well, I just feel like something like this, the North Face is sponsoring it, and they want their name on it. And I think anytime you do that, you put your name on something, you can't act shocked, especially if it's something controversial like this, something that many people, mainstream people, look at and are not comfortable with it. There might be a little bit of a pushback.
I think you're acting... I'll also say you might want to get a little bit more on top of the mic when you're speaking. I think you're being awfully calm about this, and I know we see this kind of stuff all the time, so it's easy to just kind of ignore it. But to me, it's kind of a caricature of itself. This seems like something that would be in a comedy bit from like the early 2000s, like someone making fun of it. Genuinely.
Yeah, but I think that I mean, I'm so desensitized to this. I've seen so much of this. You know, when
that's sad.
It's
sad for everybody.
I really, you know, as far as the outrage, I wouldn't say I'm filled with outrage. I just look at it and shake my head and say, you know, what are you really accomplishing here? To me, you know, the video itself is a caricature of, is this a transgender person, Polly Patagonia, whatever her name is? Is it supposed to be a caricature of a transgender person, of a drag queen, of a gay person? I'm just wondering what the goal of this video and of this camp really is. I would think that
be gay and do gay arts, according to this person.
If the goal is to make gay people feel accepted and safe, I'm not sure that this presentation.
No, it makes it worse.
I mean, because number one, I know gay people, and they're not like that. And I would think a lot of people who are transgender aren't like that. That they would that there's, you know, the flamboyance or the, you know, the, it's really a caricature of a gay person.
Yeah.
And I would think that it's the same with, like, if you had a camp for any other type of ethnic group, I don't think you would want to overplay that, the stereotypes or the caricatures about it. So that's the first thing I see. I mean, that's where you hear it, and it's desensitizing, and it's, I just don't think that, I think it's a vehicle for people to say, you know, we're going to be out loud, that this is what we're about, and we know it's going to be the point where it annoys and upsets other people. And that's part of our goal. And I that's the first half I see. And then I just look at it, and I'm trying to look at it from another point of view and say, how is any of this really beneficial? And that, and I don't see it other than it's an attempt. They know it's going to antagonize people, and they know they're going to antagonize people, and it's going to cost them some sales temporarily. Boycotts don't usually last very long if you've got an established product, and the North Face is one of the leaders in outerwear, in winter outerwear.
Oh yeah, it's great, great product.
So I think that, you know, rarely do they work long term. Bud Light is a case study, but honestly, I think what did it with Bud Light was,
I was going to say, that you think they'd be a little bit more fearful given what recently happened.
Well, yeah, Bud Light, when they said, we want to shed our current market, our current beer drinkers are sophomoric frat boys or something like that. Who does that? Who says that about their customer base? And, you know, and I think the other thing is, a lot of products are supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
And when you start sucking the fun out of it, well, your beer, when, you know, beer is supposed to be fun. It's not...
it's not supposed to be political.
It's not supposed to... No, it's supposed to be political. I mean, when do you pull out a beer? If you're a responsible drinker, you drink with, you know, to celebrate with friends... after a long day's work.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to symbolize fun, relaxation, getting away from the stresses of the world. And instead, they're bringing something in that is very controversial, and they're making you face it. And then they say, oh, by the way, we think you suck. I mean, what were they expecting? Now, this year, I think that they're trying... They're testing the market here.
Yeah.
To see if anyone really cares.
It's also a lot easier, I think, to get away with it when you're North Face because, well, Bud Light is more for men and typically people who might... You might buy a Bud Light every single night, but you'd buy a North Face once every couple of years at most.
You're not throwing out a $200 coat to start with.
Oh, 100% no. But it's very easy for me to be like, I'm just not going to drink Bud Light for the next couple of weeks.
Right.
Over the next couple of months, if everybody kind of does that. But also, there's a whole camaraderie there.
But yeah, I just look at this and it's like they want outrage. I'm just like, you guys are idiots. It's one thing to say there's a camp for teenagers that's supposed to
be beneficial in any way
for them because they are coming out of the closet and it's hard. Now I'll argue it's probably as easy to do it as any time in history right now.
Yeah, definitely.
But I can't say I know what it all entails.
I've
never had to,
the idea of going away somewhere to celebrate sexuality, how are you okay with that as a parent? No matter the context, like...
Well, what if they had a hetero camp for boys and girls?
God, I would never let my child go to that.
There'd be no gender-segregated cabins And we're going to talk about,
So remember what we learned in class today? Why don't we practice or whatever?
Right. And
because, that's what happens.
Well, a lot of overnight camps, when you talk about kids that age, and there are boys and girls, and they're in separate areas.
There are
ways that they'll sneak. Yeah. I mean, that was the old, when I was in college and a fraternity was doing Rush, and we had to, reach out to potential pledges. We had to sometimes go, or actual pledges. We had to go see if they were studying and so forth.
Yeah.
So we had to go into dorms and like, well, they're locked down. And we're like, well, if there was a girl in there that you wanted to visit, you'd find a way to get in there.
Oh yeah.
Right. So, but. That's all beside the point. I'm looking at this and just I don't know if I'm just burned out by it, but I just think that it's silly. I think North Face, as you said, it's a camp based on sexuality or sex, really.
Yeah.
It's that video, it's such a horrible.
It's embarrassing.
I mean,
North Face should feel embarrassed.
You think if there was a Catholic camp or a Jewish camp or a camp for Asian teens, which there are, and they had some type of video promoting it, and
it was
used
super
tropes.
Stereotyped.
Yeah. I mean, I would think that people would be like, this is, what are you doing at this camp? How is this beneficial?
Yeah, could you imagine if an Asian camp, they effectively put on like the City Walk guy from South Park as their advertiser, because like that's the equivalent. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
South Park. Like that's the equivalent to the level of stereotype where it's just so egregious.
Right, and it's just I just look at it and just scratch my head, and it's like as far as the outrage, we've had all this stuff.
Yeah,
been
this is not as bad as it
gets.
We've
been through a lot of other things. It's not as I just shrug my shoulders at it, and I hope that I'm wrong and there's some benefit somewhere, because otherwise are you messing up kids?
No, I mean they are messing up kids.
And I don't wish harm on anybody, and if people need some type of therapeutic counseling or an overnight camp maybe provides an avenue for some type of, for lack of a better term, therapy or counseling for a teen struggling with this.
Well, don't you think normal camp would just be like a good coping mechanism generally? You go to a normal camp, like that's therapeutic in its own way.
I would think, but I'm just saying.
But I know what you're saying, yeah.
I'm just saying that this the way that they're advertising this camp, I just look at it and say, is this beneficial? And North Face is doing this. They want to score points with a certain group. And they're saying they don't mind pissing off others. And is it is this really necessary? I mean,
well, I guess if there was a time to do it, it'd be now going into the summer months because no one's buying.
No one's buying any winter. Yeah, so no maybe one's buying any
maybe that's the mark because they'll forget by the time it's coat buying season.
And I think, well, I think that's,
and actually that might be pretty smart.
That's what I was saying is that Bud Light was the exception to the rule. Otherwise, you really, I mean, you see all these corporate faux pas, and they just happen one after another after another, and people are like, oh, I'm never buying from your company again, and never doing this or that. And really, if it's a durable good, you really can't afford to eliminate a stalwart. So for example, if Maytag does something to piss you off, well, that's all well and good until you're ready to buy a laundry machine. And
yeah, that's
you know
like
what
the
I
only
mean?
Option. Or the best option.
A car company or whatever. And as far as Bud Light goes, that's the exception to the rule. I think the way that was executed, they're going to be talking about that in business school for years to come.
I heard it's already in some courses.
I'm sure it is.
But let's transition this. So yeah, speaking of transitions, there's unfortunately, there's this law that got introduced, it looks like, in Illinois, and it effectively says that if you're a minor who is 12 years of age or older, they may sign and file an application on the minor's own behalf if such application is for Article 5 family planning. I won't bore you with the actual code of it. Pretty much, though, the reason this was introduced, if a 13-year-old wants to get transitioned, if they want to have an abortion, they don't need the consent of the parent. So where is your head on this one?
I mean, it just follows the rash of laws that have been going through the Illinois General Assembly the last couple of years. I mean, the parental notification law was overturned, and it was overturned basically, or it was repealed basically because Democratic-controlled legislature and J.B. Pritzker wanted to out-pro-choice other states. And there were provisions in the bill that allowed for a judge and a social worker to bring the child in front of a judge if it were a case of an abusive household where somebody wanted to get this abortion. They again are looking at different ways. How do we get to your kids and take away the parental rights? I mean, as it is, my son's 14. I take him in to see the doctor, and he can say he doesn't consent to me hearing the full story of what's going on with him. Now, on the other hand, they seem to say, Mr. Brown, where's your health insurance card? And your insurance is only going to pay for this
much.
The balance is due from you. So, you know, that's fun. But, you know, Kelly Cassidy does not care or know what's better for my...
And that's the person who introduced the bill.
Yeah. Kelly Cassidy is a state representative from... I think she's Northside, Andersonville, Uptown, Lakeview.
Yeah,
that
it
area.
Just says Chicago, so I'm guessing North Chicago.
Yeah, she's Northside, and I think it's Andersonville, Uptown, that area, like around Lawrence. But she does not know what's better for my child, for my children, than I do. She does not care about my children more than I do, and she can say she does. But Kelly, what are their names?
Yeah,
I say that somewhat in jest, but I think that making laws like this, and the argument is it's to shield children from abusive or neglectful parents, and you're managing for the rule, not the exception, and.
We see that a lot with laws.
Right. So, I mean, we see that a lot. And so what you're doing is the overwhelming majority of parents are caring, attentive, good parents.
At the very least, they're not abusive parents.
They're not abusive. And you know what? I mean, we could go talk about how our parents came up short different times.
Sure.
I mean, my parents were not perfect. I'm certainly not perfect.
Nobody is.
No, and you know, I being a parent is difficult, but it takes up a lot of your time trying to at least my own, and I can't speak to other people. Maybe other people just don't care. Their kids go to bed and they're just like, okay, it's or they want to go somewhere, they call in a babysitter and it's okay, we're gonna forget about it. Or
sure.
You know, kids come home from school, they don't care what their kids are doing in school or what they're learning or if they're learning. But my experience is most parents, it occupies a lot of their headspace. Are they doing right by their children? What can they do for their children? What's the right call? And it doesn't mean that they may always make the right choices, but they've invested so much time in their children. And every time the government comes in and says, you have less control over how your children are raised, I mean, it's insulting, but it's par for the course for them. It's par for the course for them. And there are probably 40 state representatives that I really struggle to see what the real differences are among them. That they're just the same. They're just the same. They don't really bring anything new. And I really believe that a lot of the bills they bring forward, they just kind of say, okay, we're bringing these bills forward and we're going to draw straws to see who gets it. Or maybe not draw straws, but instead they look at their district. Oh, this would be a good healthcare issue for you. This would be a good LGBTQ for you. This is a good pro-choice bill for you.
It's all surrounded around this social progressivism. A lot of the things you hear in the media, I think a big part of the Democratic strategy, I know a big part of the left strategy includes this idea of, oh, we need social progress. But they're not progressive policies. I mean, imagine if it was 20 years ago, TJ. Okay, so I was 5 years old, so you would know better than me. 20 years ago, if the current state of the society and the Democratic Party looked the way it did now, it wouldn't even be possible. Well, because the idea of even introducing a law like this then would have been ludicrous.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, you go back to 2004. 2008, I'm sorry, 2006, there's a clip that I just saw of Senator Joe Biden on Meet the Press with Tim Russert, and he kind of goes off on something about, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act, I voted for that, that's law of the land. Marriage is between a man and a woman only, and states have to respect that, and it's not going to change anytime soon. And that was 2006, and things did change. And, you know, maybe it was for the best, but you've seen such a shift on a lot of issues when it comes to abortion. I mean, that was Clinton's thing in 1992 when he ran for office. You know, we had 12 years of Reagan and Bush, and Reagan was a very pro-life president. And people point out he was California governor. He did sign a couple very liberal abortion laws, but I believe his opinion changed over time. And
I actually read a book about him in his General Electric years. I'm sorry to cut you off. I just want to mention this. It's like the General Electric years of Reagan. He went to all the General Electric plants and met he met Americans from every small town, every large town. Yep. And I had no idea, you know, because I haven't been around too long. You don't know until you learn about something. But I just, that is such a quality thing to have happened, to have a president be able to actually go around and meet actual citizens working in actual factories from all across the nation, all from different backgrounds. You go to these people's houses, talk to them. So that's, I mean, I think the way he sort of progresses throughout life, I think reflects all the people he talked to and interviewed and worked with. And he was on TV and stuff too. And just very interesting. Sorry, I didn't mean to go on this little sidebar.
No,
I think that's really interesting how that sort of happens.
Well, Reagan had a very interesting journey in his life. I mean, he was a New Deal Democrat in the 30s and into the 40s. And I think he was president of that, I think it was the Screen Actors Guild. And it was during McCarthyism. And it was then after that. And he was a spokesman for General Electric and hosted the General Electric Theater. And that's when he met a lot of people. And I think that's where he looked at things. And his 1964 speech, it was sort of Goldwater's Hail Mary. He was behind so far with LBJ. And there's an interesting book on Goldwater's campaign William F. Buckley wrote, which I thought was...
I haven't read that.
It's a short book. It's fun. And it's just how, you know, Goldwater was basically swimming upstream, and he was he knew it was an uphill battle. You know, the premise of the book is he lost the battle, but, oh, you know, within 16 years, you had Ronald Reagan elected president, which was a real you saw a real realignment of the political landscape with Reagan. And it started really with Goldwater. And so Reagan gave the speech in 1964, and he...
Is that his Rendezvous with Destiny speech? Or is
it's a time for choosing, and yes, we're on a rendezvous with destiny. You know, America's the last hope on earth. It sums up really the conservative ideology that would dominate for the next... probably, I'd say 40 years, because I mean...
Even today, people refer to Reagan...
Right.
Not, maybe not policy-wise, but he is still gold standard for the right.
Well, you know, policy-wise, I think you saw some of his policies. He took office in 1981, and we had double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment, and double-digit interest rates. Over time, he was able to, by 1983 into 1984, he won by such a landslide because unemployment had been cut in half and inflation was under control. People were doing well.
Yeah.
And there was hope. And Reagan spoke, you know, he really appealed to our better angels in a lot of ways. And made people feel good about being an American, and was full of hope in his speeches. I really think that's why he appealed to the independent voters more than anything. But and I think what you saw after that, for the next 25 years going into 2008, we saw relative calm economically. I mean, there was a little post-Gulf War recession in 1992. One into early 1992, that was over by the time. I mean, it was over during the third quarter of 1992, but it was too late for Bush to get anywhere on Clinton. And Clinton, he moderated his platform a little bit, and he was really a centrist. Yeah, I wouldn't even say he was center left from 1995 on to the end of his presidency when it came to economic policy. He got spanked hard. He tried to pass Hillary Clear. And
what's that?
It was her health care
plan. Oh, it's her health care plan.
He put her in charge of getting the health care plan. And so she came out with it, and it was socialized medicine, and it was rejected. And then he lost both houses of Congress. We had not controlled both houses of Congress since the Eisenhower administration. So that was a major change. I mean, I remember talking to Mark Kirk many years ago when he was still a congressman, and he had worked for John Porter. And he said there were a lot of people in the Republican caucus who wouldn't even entertain the idea of being the majority in the House of Representatives. It had been so long. And that change, I mean, it changed all, it made Clinton change his tune on a lot of things. And, you know, he and Newt Gingrich clashed a lot But they got a lot done.
I was just about to mention, because that's where I learned that, you know, the Republicans hadn't held Bolton so long, from his book, March to Majority. Have you read that?
No.
I think it just came out maybe this year or last year. It's pretty recent. Very good. It gives a good history of the Republican Party from a national point of view.
Well, 1994 was an interesting year because what the Republicans really did, they said, okay, why are people so angry? I mean, there was a huge anti-incumbent sentiment, which is great if you're in the minority. Not so good if you're in the majority. And there were a number of House scandals. I mean, there was the post office scandal, the House bank scandal. Dan Rostenkowski here, he was under indictment at the time, under federal indictment at the time. He was running down in the 5th District on the Northwest side. And like the idea of him losing is sort of like the idea of, name your Democratic congressman in Illinois losing. Someone that entrenched. I mean, I guess... it's you think about Akeem Jeffries in New York, the idea of him losing or something like that. He lost to Michael Flanagan, who basically ran because he was complaining about Congress and somebody dared him to run. But it was in 90 going to 94. The Republicans and Newt Gingrich was behind it. They looked at what people were most upset with, and they created this thing called the Contract with America.
Yeah,
and all these congressmen signed on to it, and it was very simple. You know, term limits. I think zero-based budgeting might have been in it. Ways to cut out pork and earmarks and try to get spending under control. And they were successful. And Clinton, to his credit, he worked with the Republicans in Congress to kind of triangulate. And so, you know, in the late 90s, I mean, one thing that stands out to me, inflation was... negligible. I mean, we had $1 gas.
Oh yeah.
You know, you'd say, "Oh, how many gallons?"
It's like $4.20, $4.30 now.
Yeah, it's $4.30 now. I mean, that's
in Illinois.
In Illinois, I mean, it's outstripped the pace of inflation. But fuel prices were cheap, food prices were cheap. I mean, everything was relatively inexpensive. My wedding ring. I remember I got that in 2003. The gold was. Not even $400 an ounce, I don't think.
What is it at right now?
Over 1,700. It might be over
2,000. I was
going
to say close to $2,000, yeah.
I don't sit here monitoring commodity prices like some people do, and I don't own... I'm skeptical of the efficacy of gold as an investment vehicle, but when you have commodities like that, I remember in the early 2000s, 2001, 2002, we were making a bus part. We were making was this fuse, a ceramic fuse, and it was gold plated.
Okay.
Now, I mean, very thin gold, but it offered a greater heat dissipation.
Sure.
And durability, and you could afford to do that because gold was not super expensive. The dollar was fairly strong. Now, there were a number of things that happened. The dot-com crash.
Yeah.
As we were recovering from that, you had 9/11. Then you had some wars. You had the credit crisis, which really ran from subprime lending. You began to feel that in late 2006, and it really ran until 2009. And it took a lot of things down with it. You had the automobile companies that needed bailouts. You had... a lot of upheaval, but even through that, then Obama comes in and he has this huge stimulus, which I think at the time seemed outrageous. It was over $1 trillion. And since then after the war, which by the way, cost a lot of money, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq cost a lot of money. So, my party can can own that.
Donald Trump recently gave his sort of press release on his thoughts on the future of abortion in America. And pretty much what he said was, we're just going to leave it up to the states. We're not going to do anything from a federal ban standpoint. And, well, what do you think about that?
I think it's smart politics. For the most part, agree with him with what he's trying to say. It's a states issue. That's what Roe v. Wade did, was take it away from the states. And by making it a state issue, it's making it an issue that the people are closer to. So, yeah. You know, J.B. Pritzker keeps preening around saying how he's out pro-choicing everybody in the country. Well, you know, that's the state of affairs in Illinois. I'm not happy with a lot of it, but those are the breaks. And I'm aware of what the sentiment is in the area. I do think the other thing that Roe v. Wade has done is that we're seeing spasms right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, prior to Dobbs, you had people who said, I'm pro-life or pro-choice. It was very binary, where if you wanted Roe v. Wade to be upheld, you'd be considered pro-choice. If you wanted Roe v. Wade not to be upheld, you were pro-life. And I'll go one step further. I think Roe v. Wade allowed for no restrictions on abortions up to 20 weeks. After that, it was up to...
Yeah, gestation, which is up to... Kind of the...
It's 40 weeks, so, yeah, so I mean, you're talking
some
half...
Some doctors were a little bit... I think it depended, but yeah.
But I mean, Roe v. Wade said 20 weeks.
Yeah.
So then states were free to, you know, have less restricted abortion... Have any abortion law they wanted that was at least as unrestrictive as that. They couldn't have anything more restrictive. And to boil it, to simplify it, so all you lawyers out there... I understand there's a little more to it, but to simplify it, that's really what Roe v. Wade said, is that there in the Constitution is a right to this. And I don't necessarily see that right. Now, it's been overturned. There are people who thought that it made abortion illegal everywhere. No, it didn't do that. What we're seeing is a great unwinding. I mean, what you see in Arizona is this old abortion law. And
was that like 1864?
Yeah, it was when Arizona was a territory, which included present-day New Mexico and part of Nevada. And,
sure.
And probably didn't include the southern Arizona, which was came in the Gadsden Purchase, which I think came later. I'd have to check the history book on that.
So regardless.
But regardless, I'm saying it was a... totally different world in a lot of different ways. But I understand that the court just said that the law that was passed was not passed correctly. The way the law was written was unconstitutional for whatever reason. There is a path to pass that same law again where it would be constitutional and it would repeal that 1860s law. And I think maybe the problem was they didn't explicitly repeal that 1860s law.
That's probably definitely what happened.
But that's one thing. The courts will say ball or strike.
Yeah.
So, okay, if they're not giving you the outside corner and they're calling it the same way the entire time, don't throw a pitch that catches the outside corner if you want them to take for a strike.
Yeah.
On a 3-0 count, you probably shouldn't throw there unless you want to give the guy first base. It's the same thing. There's a path to create abortion policy that fits. I consider myself pro-life, but now I look at it and say, well, I'm mainly pro-life. There have been polls out there where most Americans, and I say most Americans, about 70 to 85% of Americans believe there should either be exceptions, that they're pro-life with exceptions,
yeah,
or they're pro-choice with restrictions.
Limits. Yeah.
And so... Now, I mean, it's no longer a binary. There's a lot of real estate between heartbeat law and partial birth abortion at 40 weeks. And again, spare me that, oh, it never really happens. And I know, but yeah, it never really happens. And why not just prohibit it? Except in the cases where there's a dire health emergency to the mother of the child. So right now we're trying to out pro-choice the blue states and the pro-life red states. Some of them are trying to out pro-life each other.
Yeah.
Those spasms, I think, are kind of ending. And I think Arizona was trying to pass something that fit where their people sat. I think abortion is as abortion is as controversial as it is because I think you have two sacred competing principles. The right to live and to protect and the duty to protect those with no voice, the most vulnerable in our society, and the right to be a free person and, you know, do as you please to yourself. And as I explained last episode, I'm very libertarian oriented. So I sympathize with that. Sure. And I you know, despite what people say, I am not able to, at no point in my life have I or will I be able to get pregnant. And I've been fortunate enough where pregnancies in my life have been a cause of celebration, where one needs to, feels the need to have an abortion, comes from a point of tragedy or sadness. And I don't think we talk enough about, instead of, I find it offensive to celebrate your abortion. It's one thing if someone says, okay, I had an abortion and this is why I had it, and the way they feel they would do it again. I personally am opposed to it, but take a stand. But to celebrate such a thing, yeah, that really is a bit of a turnoff. And I think it reduces the seriousness of it. So again, I think you're seeing spasms in the abortion debate where Dobbs happened, and you have pro-choice is all upset by it, pro-life is all excited about it, when really now the work is what needs to be done. And the truth is there are two competing sacred values, the right over your own person, the right to live your life as you see fit, and the duty to protect the most vulnerable in our society, and the right to life of every person. And I think there's a debate as to when someone is
a person.
And I what I believe and what a lot of people believe, there might be some wiggle room. And then you think about when you pass a law, enforcement, and you think about what's reasonable, and you think about what will eventually create the best result. And I think the best result would be less demand, less of the tragedy that makes people seek abortion, and more freedom. And I really think that now the hard work, if state legislatures want to do it, is ready to start. And that would be the Illinois legislature, a pro-choice legislator, saying, you know what? I have to listen to my constituents. I have to listen to my own conscience. Maybe 40 weeks and no parental notification and taxpayer money for every type of abortion and sex selective abortions and so on and so forth. Maybe that's a little too extreme. And it would require in Missouri or Alabama or other states that passed really restrictive abortion statutes to look at it and say, well, wait a second. There are cases. I mean, I know people who've been told that their child is going to be stillborn. It's still alive now, but the child's either going to be stillborn or live a day or two because of severe, severe genetic deformities, which will make their existence one of pain. Now, I'm not a big euthanasia fan.
But they recently introduced that in Illinois,
too. Yeah, I'm against euthanasia. But in those cases, I can at least sympathize and understand the reasons one would want to seek an abortion in those cases.
I could sympathize with that.
That said, I think what we have now, there's no serious discussion. We're just talking at each other. And Illinois won't do it. Why? Personal PAC is one of the biggest donors to the Democratic Party that's not named J.B. Pritzker. So why would they? They know where their bread's buttered.
Yep.
And Personal PAC, by the way, I tell candidates who want to run for office in this area, they say, well, I'm pro-choice, and this, you know, polls show on the North Shore and the North suburbs, most voters are pro-choice. And I say, well, that's great and all. And if you're pro-choice, you should say you're pro-choice. If you're pro-life, you should say you're pro-life. But you should show where you stand on it and defend it. Because no matter if you say, I'm going to require everybody to have an abortion once just to have it, and then you get a big party and a trip around the world and everything like that, it doesn't matter. Your Democratic opponent is going to be, in the eyes of Personal PAC, more pro-choice than you. I would love to do a study on it. It's a hunch, but I think Personal PAC spends more on defeating pro-choice Republicans than it does on pro-life Republicans. They know where the bread's buttered. It's with the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party knows where the bread's buttered. It's Personal PAC.
Yep.
That's just the way it is. But it's not going to advance the discussion. And I really urge you, the listener, the individual person out there, no matter where you are in the abortion debate, I believe you should err on the side of life. And where there's life, there's hope.
I think that's very well said. And I think that's just a very reasonable approach to it. And a very political one. Politically... mindful one, because I mean, the whole job of representatives is to represent the people. So sometimes I feel like when people get elected, they'll say, I personally believe this, and that's fine and dandy, but your job is to be a servant as an elected official, right? So even if you kind of disagree with something or you kind of agree more with something, ultimately you need to represent your people.
Well, I think also an issue like this, finding a consensus is what's healthy for the republic. Finding a consensus where you might say, I don't agree with the law completely, but I can live with it. I can live with it the way it is. Under these circumstances, in this cultural environment, I can live with it. And unfortunately, I see in movements like this, the pro-choice and pro-life movement, it's not in the interests of lobbyists and of activists to let this go away, because it's turned into people make a lot of money advocating for or against abortion. And it's one of those issues the Republican Party can't run away from. We need to defend it. And the Democrats think it's a winning issue for them. And around here, it may be, if you make it a binary. But we need to have a more thoughtful discussion. And listen to people who want to have a good faith discussion. Because right now, that's not what's going on. And the people in power, as we talked about earlier, they're interested in just passing a litany of laws. They have confused activity for achievement. Because every state legislator talks about how many bills they co-sponsored, how many bills they authored, and how many bills they passed. And I guess the question is, well, was it a good law?
Yeah. Honestly, I would have preferred if a lot of those people go into office and just sit on their hands.
Right. Or spend. I think the General Assembly should spend 2 weeks at every session looking at which laws they need to repeal. You repeal those laws, and then you can institute new ones to replace those.
You should have to repeal. I don't know if we should give them a quota, but it should be you have to at least make an effort to repeal some laws, because Well, even this one would go against us. Even the thing in Arizona from 1864, whatever, that ends up kicking in. Take a look at what's on the books, because sometimes when push comes to shove and you have to look at the law, it's like, this actually doesn't make any sense.
Well, you hear about these town ordinances, and there are some state laws that are bizarre. Like, you can't, like, ride your bike whistling Yankee Doodle Dandy on a Sunday in the state of Minnesota.
And those are the silly examples, but there are...
Repeal those. I think it would be nice on tax law. Throw out the entire tax code. Let's start from zero. You talk about a code that does not benefit individuals in this country. It doesn't benefit businesses that aren't looking to game the system.
Yeah.
And I think that's some place where we could really, again, start the discussion. Let's throw the whole damn thing out and make it simple enough so that almost all people could fill out their return on the back of a postcard, which takes away a lot of the deductions, which mostly benefit the well-off. And, you know, the standard deduction that Trump introduced actually, and, you know, the Democrats are complaining about the local tax exemption being capped at $12,000, this is the SALT deduction. But you get a $12,000 standard deduction or $24,000 deduction as a married couple. That's a lot of money you can write off. And as you get wealthier, you're capped on what you can write off to a certain degree. Yeah. I think there should be more that you're capped on write-offs. And I think that, you know, I always find it ironic. You listen to any State of the Union address, and I started counting at one point. 1 year, Obama mentioned, we got to get rid of all these loopholes so companies can pay their fair share. And then for the next hour, he listed all these different tax credits and deductions that he was going to offer to companies so they can train more employees, so they can, you know, grow their business, so they can do this, they can do what, all these different activities that he wanted them to do. He was dangling tax deductions or tax credits. And
he's in both lanes at once.
What are they but loopholes? But again, sometimes I feel like we need a lot more serious leadership.
Agreed.
And we're reduced to sound bites. I think it's interesting. People, you know, Trump gets lampooned sometimes for being very simplistic in the way he talks and being bombastic and so forth. But his whole thought that the state should decide, I think that's appropriate. I think the state should decide more things. And I think it'll put pressure on people to start paying attention to what's going on around here. Are your leaders serious enough? Are they handling things? And who are your state representatives and state senators? Who's on your school board?
Yeah.
Who's on your village board? The more that you pass off to local government, the closer government is to you. So anyway. I
think that all of those are excellent points. And speaking of serious leadership, I'm going to transition this because I know we could talk about just about anything for hours on end here. I'm actually going to transition to the judge that released a driver who was charged for killing a DeKalb County deputy, citing the Safety Act. So DeKalb County, Illinois, Safety Act is a Safety Act or Safe Act?
It's a Safety.
Yeah, Safety
it's
Act.
It's an acronym.
Okay, so anyways, this person, they murdered, I think allegedly, because they haven't been officially convicted, but they killed the cop.
Right.
The deputy. And this person, per this law, was released because they can't. Here, let me pull up the actual thing here, so I'm not speaking.
What were they charging?
So the court hearing with the family and friends, the Judicial Circuit Court Judge Marcy Buick cited the Safety Act and what it required to be considered when deciding whether to detain someone prior to a trial. Under the new law, all defendants are presumed to be eligible for pretrial release. We have all learned over the last 6 months that these hearings are complicated. Judges are required to uphold and apply the law.
Right. Well, I think, you know, one thing is that we looked at, the judges had to, and they amended this part, where you could be released if you didn't, you had to pose a specific threat. So to you, somebody.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So apparently murder's not one of those threats.
So let's say, this guy's in here. He's a threat to kill somebody.
Sure.
Well, did he say he's going to kill anybody in particular? No, but he said, he could be a threat to anybody. Well, that wouldn't meet the threshold. But if it's somebody who came in and said, well, he threatened his wife that he's going to beat the crap out of her. Well, then they'd be able to detain him pre-trial. They changed that, where they loosened up what constitutes an act of threat. But they have forcible felonies. And I think forcible felonies, I don't think you have to prove an act of threat. So I don't know how this doesn't fit that standard. I think the judge, I don't know what the judge is trying to prove.
How terrible of a situation. This is an awful case. You know, this is one of those things where you wonder why more. I mean, this, we're going to talk about this every week, but this is one of those things where it's like, well, of course more people are leaving Illinois, because when somebody kills a cop, that person isn't immediately put into prison.
Reading between the lines here, it looks like Judge Marcy Buick, I wonder if this is her pouting about the Safety Act, which if that's the case, she should be removed from the bench. Because she's saying, under the new law, that all defendants are presumed to be eligible for pretrial release. We've learned over the last 6 months that these hearings are complicated and judges are required to uphold and apply the law. I think this might be her throwing up her hands. I don't know. I don't know enough about her. If it's her way of saying, giving the middle finger to the Safety Act, I abhor this. I think it's a terrible law, but to do that as a judge, she should be removed from the bench. Now, if instead she's being very serious and saying, I don't want to detain him because
My interpretation of the law is
this. Well, that shows the law is flawed. And so I think that there were a lot of problems with the Safety Act that were discussed during the election. The Democrats assured us there was nothing wrong with it. And the first thing they did during the lame duck session was amend it.
Yeah.
So I really think that this is just another case of that. So we need serious. Again, this comes back to serious leadership. What is the judge doing and thinking? Where's she coming from? Because if she's trying, she thinks she's advocating against the law by doing this, she should be removed from the bench.
I agree. I could definitely see it being a strategy. Like, look, because of this law, I could just let this person go.
Right. Yeah.
Which is terrible.
So I agree that the law is complicated and I just wonder what the hell's going on that someone like that should not be free. But we're seeing enough cases where people who shouldn't be free are let free. And so anyway, I think the other thing going on right now.
Well, imagine being the family at the deputy's funeral, knowing that the killer. It's like, wow, but my family member risked their life every day to serve and protect their community every single day, and no one's going to serve and protect and do the right thing here, put this person in prison.
Right. Yeah. It's one of those things that the victims, it's adding to the trauma the victims are going through, and the family of the victim, so...
Definitely. Why don't we end on a lighter note here? I'll let you lead the way. You want to talk about these hypersexualized cicadas?
Sure. Patch is a local web magazine which covers most suburbs in Chicago. And I stumbled across this this article. Hypersexualized zombie cicadas may help spread STDs in Illinois merchants. And I'm thinking, spread STDs? Well, relax, everybody. They're not going to. You're not going to get the clap from the cicadas. You know, you try. You know, go tell your girlfriend or your wife or your husband that it's between you and them. But there's apparently a fungal STD that cicadas have, and right now it's dormant. But when they come and see the light of day, this fungus will start eating away at their limbs. You know, if you don't know, we're going to get a ton of cicadas this year. It's they're two different broods that are coming, you know, that are coming to life.
Yeah,
they're dormant under the ground and they emerge every 13, 17 years. So there's a 17-year brood and there's a 13-year brood that are going to be coming alive here this summer. So it's locusts. It's not, you know, the Cubs won the World Series a few years ago, so it's not that. But they're saying that these there's an infectious fungal pathogen, and they say it's laced with the same chemical found in psychedelic mushrooms and street amphetamines, such as crystal meth.
Nice. You love to hear that.
So they say, and as these psychoactive compounds do to humans, the fungus, which lies dormant in the soil until the cicadas push through it in their emergence, causes some bizarre cicada behavior. I'm here for it. Both broods are susceptible to the infection, which is detected within a week or 10 days of emergence. So basically what happens is the fungus overtakes their bodies and eats through their limbs. Their abdomens fall off as the fungus grows like a sponge inside them. And their genitals fall off.
Hmm.
Yet they persist, spreading the equivalent of an insect sexually transmitted disease. So be thankful that this STD is not transmittable.
Very true.
To humans. But the cicada continues to participate in normal activities like it would if it was healthy, says this West Virginia University professor. Like it tries to mate, it flies around, it walks on plants, yet a third of its body has been replaced by fungus. That's really kind of bizarre. And the fungus will still recognize the hormonal signal from other cicadas. So they will continue to try to mate. And, you know, the buzzing you hear are males trying to attract female cicadas to mate. So So males, for example, they'll continue to try and mate with females unsuccessfully because, again, their back end is a fungus. But they're also pretend to be females to get males to come to them. And that doubles the number of cicadas that an infected individual comes into contact with. So, you know, this is all just bizarre. It just seems like a nightmare because when you not only have cicadas, you've got zombie cicadas, you know, sleeping around. So the article goes on to ask, and it's a very good question. Can a person get high eating a cicada infected by the fungus?
It's a great question.
Great question. So this West Virginia professor, University of West Virginia professor says, maybe, if you're motivated enough. Knowing some people,
oh yeah,
they will be motivated enough.
100%. I have to admit, I think I know some people that they might be motivated enough.
So the professor says there may be other things in the cicada that might not be so healthy. So if you eat a lot of cicadas, you might get high, but you also might get very sick. Again, I'm guessing you're going to see a lot of suburban and city of Chicago hospitals treating people who ingested a lot of cicadas trying to get buzzed.
That'd be a headline.
So it reminds me of the mid-90s episode of Beavis and Butthead where, you know, the whole premise is they're idiots. They're, you know, teenage boys with no motivation, no intelligence. They're dumb. And we find it funny because when it came out, I was either finishing up high school or starting college. And I would meet a lot of people like that. And they, at one point, Beavis tells, or Butthead tells Beavis, let's go find a toad because licking the toad could get you high.
This is the modern day version of that.
Yeah. So here's Beavis.
Anything yet? Are you sure you're licking right?
Yeah.
I don't get it. It's supposed to pack an awesome buzz.
Tastes like chicken.
Here, Toady.
Yeah, so when I was in Boy Scouts, we cooked up cicadas. This is when the first 17-year cicadas came, mm-hmm. when we ate them. So hopefully they didn't have them then.
They're supposed to be
high in protein or something.
High in protein, yeah. Some cultures, it's a delicacy. So, I mean, it's not like they're cockroaches eating, like, God knows what, you know, bottom of your pantry. But I have not eaten cicadas. I'm not advocating for that. I know there are some people who are pro bug eating.
Yeah.
So maybe
maybe our leftist friends will be eating more cicadas.
You can get high and save the earth.
Which, that's, honestly, that's probably their match made in heaven. They can get high while saving the earth. I think that'll be a good note for us to end on.
I don't know about you, but I'm hungry. I'm going to go have dinner.
Yeah.
My appetite hasn't been bigger. So see you next week, Jeff.
Yeah. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to give a little outro here just for the people on the YouTube channel.
Sure. I'm TJ. I live in Northbrook, and I am the Republican committeeman here in Northfield Township, which includes Northbrook, most of Glenview, and half of Northfield up on the north shore of Chicago, northern Cook County.
Awesome. I'm going to probably put this at the end of each segment here. Thanks for watching this clip. If you want to listen to the whole thing regularly, the podcast will be uploaded on wherever you listen to podcasts, and we'll do shorter segments on the YouTube channel probably for now. Why don't you let me know in the comments what you think? My name is Beans. Thank you for watching the Daily Beans / listening to the Red Beans podcast. Have a blessed day.